Last Tuesday, April 22nd, marked 58 years to that day that St. Christopher's new church building, the one over there where the offices and the guild room are now located, was dedicated by then new Bishop John Hines in 1956. Preaching that day was the outgoing Bishop Clinton Quinn. These two bishops became pillars of the church, one whose name bears the title of the Quinn Foundation, from which strategic grants are made to congregations for newly ordained clergy, mission projects that congregations take on, and many other mission and ministry grants for the spread of the good news of Jesus Christ and of God's kingdom. The other bishop went on to become known nationally. Bishop Hines served as coadjutor under Bishop Quinn for 10 years and became diocesan bishop in 1955. 9 years later, in 1964, Bishop Hines was elected the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, where he served for 9 years. Now, of course, for Texans, having one of our own become a presiding bishop at 54 years of age, no less, is an exciting thing for the people of the diocese. But what Bishop Hines is very much known for was his commitment to social justice, who guided the church through the social turmoil of the 1960s and helped open clerical ranks to women and to African Americans. Bishop Hines was also dedicated to the desegregation of Episcopal schools and churches, which met much opposition in the South. But he did not waver. As a matter of fact, Bishop Hines said, if the Episcopal Church should die because of desegregation and civil rights, then so be it. As heralds of the gospel of Jesus Christ, we are not called to preserve an institution, but to practice justice and mercy at whatever the cost. As it is written in the book of Proverbs, when justice is done, it is a joy to the righteous, but dismay to evildoers. Looking through the historic worship service books here at St. Christopher's is quite interesting. There is great history here. Much of this history is attributed to this parish finding itself in one of the greatest dioceses in the Episcopal Church. It's exciting to see the bishops that have made their way through this wonderful historic parish, the same bishops whose photographs line the walls of the diocesan center downtown. And our current bishop even has some of his own history here, as Bishop Andy's father was an associate rector while the two-year-old attended our day school. But make no mistake, this congregation itself has preserved in this part, persevered in this part of Houston for nearly 60 years, and this year we celebrate that milestone. But we don't celebrate history for history's sake. As Episcopalians, we love our Episcopal governance. That is, we love our bishops. We take pride that our bishops come from a long succeeding line of other bishops that can be traced all the way back to those first apostles, the ones upon whose heads Jesus himself had laid his hands. Our identity here at St. Christopher's is founded upon that apostolic identity. It is exciting and inspiring to know that the building across the courtyard and this building where we worship right now, at this very moment, has great history. Bishops from across the decades, indeed parishioners and families from across generations, have come through this place. Today, we continue this legacy as faithful Christians at St. Christopher's as we baptize Olivia Max, yet the next saint to be marked as Christ's own forever, right here. So we don't recall history for history's sake. Rather, we recall our history to remind us that our stories are part of the larger story of Jesus' new community, Jesus' new creation. And we are an integral part of God's ongoing salvation history. Oh, how Thomas admired and loved Jesus. And he, as much as anyone, wanted to believe that the work Jesus was doing did not come to a crashing halt on Calvary. You see, Thomas, too, believed that the political and religious forces killed Jesus once and for all. It is no wonder that the disciples were found in that room, doors locked for fear of the authorities. But Jesus comes and stands in their midst, right in front of them. He says to them, "Peace be with you," or "Shalom." This is a greeting, an ancient form of saying to or cueing the hearer that there is about to be a revelation. They are about to see, hear, or receive a revelation from God. The revelation is that the Lord is present. The Lord brings peace. The Lord brings life. Life eternal. But Thomas misses it. Now I can get all sermony here and say how unfortunate it was that Thomas wasn't there. But seriously, Thomas misses Jesus' experience. Doesn't that suck? That just must suck for Thomas. Imagine that. Poor Thomas must have felt like George Costanza in a Seinfeld episode where nothing seems to be going right for him that day. Or worse. Perhaps he's devastated at missing this historic, revelatory event. Thomas doesn't really believe the testimony of his brother disciples, does he? Their testimony should be enough, like Mary Magdalene, the apostle to the apostles, whose testimony of seeing the risen Lord was enough. So Thomas gives them an obstinate challenge. "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands, and put my finger in the mark of the nails, and my hand in his side, I will not believe." And it is at this statement that commentators over the centuries have coined the term doubting Thomas. But Professor of New Testament Cynthia Kidridge challenges this term, and I agree with her. She writes, "The repetitive detail about seeing the mark and the physical exploration of the wounds in his hands and side emphasizes the graphic event of the experience Thomas is demanding. Thomas's defiant claim that he will not believe makes the characterization of him as doubting Thomas appear quite mild and feeble. Doubting connotes being unsure. The synonym for not believing is not doubting. The Greek word that Jesus uses, apostas, which English translations render as doubt, is better translated actually as do not be believing. So a better name for Thomas might be demanding Thomas, defiant Thomas, or spiritually ambitious Thomas. Because what Thomas wants is a first-hand experience of Jesus' presence. And he describes that experience as both visual and tactile. If Thomas, like Mary, represents a kind of relationship to belief, then he represents the one who wants immediacy, physical closeness to the risen Jesus, just as the disciple whom Jesus loved was physically close to him. So now a week goes by. It is now the first celebration of the second Sunday of Easter. Jesus appears again, although the doors are shut. The disciples are still living in fear. He offers the greeting once again, "Shalom, peace be with you." Speaking now to Thomas, Jesus offers him exactly what he had so audaciously asked for. "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Literally, as Kittredge teaches, do not be unbelieving, but believing. Yes, Jesus returns to make this offering. He offers the experience Thomas needs to believe. Here we see Jesus setting the example of generosity by his gracious offer to see and touch. And we hear the astonishing words of belief as Thomas exclaims the last words an apostle speaks in this gospel, "My Lord and my God." But something else is happening here. And it is important, I think, as a present-day church community to notice that Jesus gives an instruction, Although he does this in the first visit to the disciples in that room, he says, "As the Father has sent me, so I send you." When he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit." The disciples here are given a mission. They are not instructed to remain behind closed doors Sunday after Sunday, but rather to go forth, telling the good news of Jesus' new community of love and inviting others into it. You have heard these words each time you come to worship at an Episcopal church. You hear the words at the end of the service, "Let us go forth in the name of Christ," or "Go in peace to love and serve the Lord," or "Let us go forth into the world rejoicing in the power of the Spirit," or simply, "Let us bless the Lord." Either way, we each week are sent out. And the mission is of greater importance than ever. The community who believes in the risen Jesus must proclaim him. And they must do so for those who have not had the opportunity, as Jesus' sisters and brothers, and like Thomas have, to lay eyes on him. And so we hear Jesus' final words in this chapter. "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." I think Jesus is promising all those future believers in John's first century community, as well as our 21st century, that when we hear the story of God's love, we come to faith and are blessed. Faith, after all, is hard. And believing something you haven't seen firsthand, especially so. But before I end the sermon, I want to point out how we encounter the risen Christ each week. While we are hearing of Thomas's desire for a tactile experience of the risen Jesus, it is no wonder that we too come seeking the same. Eucharist literally means to give thanks. After we give thanks, bless the bread and the cup, we touch the bread, we smell the wine, we taste it. Our Eucharistic theology is that as we receive this Holy Communion as Jesus' friends, we participate in Jesus' sacrifice for us. And that as we share in this bread and this cup, we encounter the risen Jesus and claim that he dwell in us and we in him. And this experience is only enhanced as we come to baptize today. So when we reflect, recall, and even celebrate our history as a faith community where great leaders of our church have come through these doors, like Clinton Quinn and John Hines, and the bishops that have followed, we should always realize that our recollections and pride are in vain if we fail to realize why they came through those doors in the first place. They came to tell the story of God's salvation of the world through Jesus Christ. They came to proclaim God's love and favor among God's people. They came as witnesses testifying to the historic Jesus who reveals himself in the breaking of bread. They came to pass on Jesus' blessing to us. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe. It would be fitting to conclude with our present Bishop Andy Doyle's insights. He writes, "Now that the witness of the disciples is concluded, Jesus' words are for us. The last and final beatitude is given for those who would come after. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe. Here is Jesus with us to the end, offering the last words in the original gospel. We have the opportunity to join the new covenant community, to be new Adams and new Eves, to participate in the stewardship of creation, recreated, and to take our place in the midst of the discipleship community. We do so through baptism. We do so also by embracing the charismatic word and living a resurrected life. We live by making our confession, 'My Lord and my God.' We live life, on the one hand, bearing witness to the ever-present past of crucifixion and the ever-present future of resurrected life. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing, you may have life in his name. Amen.